You're probably starting to hear some buzz about opportunity zones. They're being talked about quite a bit locally, but they're part of a federal program that was set into motion in 2017.
President Trump unveiling opportunity zones, a new policy he says will build up communities in need.
They're called opportunity zones. But whether or not these areas with special tax breaks for investors will truly help distressed communities is still uncertain.
2019 will be the real test of whether the cash gets to communities that need it.
Well, 2019 is here, so what are people thinking about the five opportunity zones in the KC Metro and their potential to bring real prosperity to what national news outlets tend to call distressed areas and what we are locally in the habit of calling blighted neighborhoods? I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR Central Standard. We're going to talk about opportunity zones, starting with what they even are. We'll get local perspective very shortly, but let's start with a national guest. Bruce Katz directs a finance lab at Drexel University in Philadelphia. He's also the author of a book, The New Localism. And Bruce, what is the very most basic explanation of an opportunity zone, what it is, how it will work? But one request, if you could explain it without using finance jargon, that'd be awesome.
Well, that'll be interesting. Well, first of all, thanks for having me. As you said, this is a provision in the 2017 tax law. It was sponsored by Senator Booker of New Jersey and Senator Scott of South Carolina. It was a bipartisan effort. And what it basically said was that an individual or corporation with capital gains, right, they could defer, reduce, or eliminate capital gains taxes.
Stop right there. What are capital gains?
Oh, if you have an increase in the value of a property or an increase in the value of a stock, those are capital gains. When you sell those assets, you pay a tax. So what the tax incentive did was give people or corporations the ability to defer, reduce, or eliminate taxes if they invested in an opportunity fund, which then invested in one of the 8,762 opportunity zones designated by governors.
Just a handful.
Well, this is why this is such a different kind of federal tax incentive. You remember empowerment zones from the Clinton administration. There were six designated in the country. We have a few more this time around.
Yeah. Well, so I'm curious, you know, I understand that governors have identified the opportunity zones within their states. So in Kansas City, Missouri, we've got five, which we'll hear about. But I'm curious about the criteria for designating a place an opportunity zone.
Well, what the federal government has is a different tax incentive, which allows you to invest in neighborhoods that have certain poverty rates or have people with incomes at a certain level of the metropolitan area's median income. So there's about 35,000 of those census tracts in the United States. The governors were told, pick a quarter of those. So these are places that, generally speaking, the poverty rate is 20% or more. And governors went about their business in radically different ways. Some consulted with communities. Some just basically did it in the state house. But that's why we have so many of these census tracts that have been designated as opportunity zones, because the federal government just basically left it up to the states. All they had to do was to meet these particular poverty thresholds.
Can we get a sense of the range of what we're talking about? Like, I understand that all of Puerto Rico is basically an opportunity zone, which, you know, after the storms of a few years back, I don't think you would hear much objection to the idea that Puerto Rico needs to rebuild. But then you hear about like the D.C. suburb that was courting Amazon's second headquarters, and that's a little like, huh?
Well, there's quite a range. And when you think about it, it really has helped not just investors, but many other stakeholders understand the geographies, the sub-geographies of cities and counties. We have downtowns, central business districts. We have areas close to downtowns. We have areas close to hospitals or universities. We have low-income neighborhoods, some of which are quite near downtown areas, some of which are more remote. We have industrial areas. We have ports. We have airports. I mean, every one of these sub-geographies has a different economic profile, a different economic relevance, many of them actually met the criteria.
Again,
it was a very simple criteria. And even in downtowns, central business districts, where there's been a lot of growth in many parts of the United States, there are also places where subsidized housing is located or housing for the homeless. I mean, that's how some of these places qualify.
So it's poverty rates for people who live in the area.
That's correct.
And when we're talking about an area that, like, people within the community generally agree pretty forcefully is truly under-resourced, truly does need some form of outside investment, what is it about this particular deal, which you've noted is bipartisan, that makes setting up shop in a place worthwhile? Because we're not talking about the trendiest districts, and you do, as a business, have to lure people to wherever you put up brick and mortar, even if we're just talking about luring employees.
Well, take the area, let's take a mile radius around 18th and Vine, for example. And this is an area that was an urban renewal area. It was devastated by freeway expansion. So there's an enormous amount of vacancy in this area, enormous amount of poverty, unemployment, et cetera, et cetera. It really exemplifies the kind of places that the sponsors of the bill intended to entice investment to. What's interesting about this area, again, the mile radius around 18th and Vine, is it's quite near Crossroads. It's quite near the hospital area. It's quite near the downtown, actually. And therefore, it's in the path of growth, but it hasn't received market investment because to a large extent, the area is on the other side of the so-called color line.
You know,
and there has been...
Yeah. Oh, sorry, I want to jump in and ask why experts might expect to see something different happen as a result of this effort than has happened with previous efforts.
Because I think it's shining a light on demand for housing or demand for business activity, which has not been met by the market.
So you're saying if you build it, they will come.
It's not just they will come. I think there is actual demand that has not been satisfied, either because banks have overlooked these areas or investors have overlooked these areas. And what this provision has done is it's compelled primarily people locally. I mean, there was a lot of talk initially about attracting investment from Silicon Valley or Boston or New York, where there's so much venture capital and wealth. Actually, there's enormous wealth and opportunity to invest in places like Kansas City. What this provision has done is basically unveiled market opportunities that have not been met.
And possibly, like, and mitigated some of the risk?
Well, there still needs to be returns on investment. So the deals that are going to happen, whether they're around housing, whether they're around commercial real estate, whether they're investment in small business, even investment in fiber infrastructure, what's going to happen, I think, is there's going to be a mix of these market investments by people with capital gains, plus bank debt, mortgages, et cetera, plus probably some kind of public incentive or even nonprofit incentive. The deals are still complicated to do because of where they're located, but I think what this...
Wait, what do you mean by that? Why?
Well, why are they complicated to do?
Yeah, why would the location make them more complicated than any other place?
It's not necessarily just the location. It's the poverty in the area, which, for example, might make some of the business propositions more difficult to invest in. One thing to recognize, by the way, is there is a lot of market capital flowing into low-income neighborhoods in the United States. It tends to be parasitic or predatory. It tends to be for check cashing outlets or payday lenders or for big box retail like Dollar General or Dollar Tree or dollar stores. So it's not like there's no capital going into low-income neighborhoods in the United States. It's a certain kind of capital.
Okay, Bruce.
And what this tax provision was basically trying to do is change and try to get more responsible investment in these places.
Okay, Bruce Katz of NOAC Finance Lab at Drexel University. Stay with me, okay?
Absolutely.
My next guest is a local guy with some local perspective. To share, he grew up in what's now an opportunity zone here in town, and he's been working on community reinvestment for around 30 years. So he's been doing it since before opportunity zones were a thing. He's the president of Community Builders, Emmett Pearson. Good morning.
Good morning.
What is Community Builders? What have you been doing there?
Community Builders is a community development corporation, which has been around since 1991. The organization started off with a $100,000 loan from, at that time, Swope Parkway Health Center, and now has grown over the last 28 years to have assets in excess of $80 million. We run the gamut of activities from affordable housing, we have grocery-anchored retail, we do Class A office space.
But when you say we do, what do you mean?
We're developers, we're real estate developers, but we're real estate developers that work hand-in-hand with the community. We typically are invited into communities to cause change. I mean, our mission...
Invited? Who invites you?
Neighborhoods, neighborhood associations, community groups. So that's where I got my start. From my mom was an old organizer and neighborhood president.
Yeah, tell me about that.
So my mom, Opal Pearson, had to give her a shout out. She was the longtime president of the Blue Hills neighborhood. So I grew up literally about 5 minutes away from where we are right now. And I have the pleasure of working every day for an organization that helps to develop communities like the Blue Hills neighborhood.
So describe the Blue Hills neighborhood to me first, starting from like when your mom was an organizer there in your childhood, and then describe it to me like the community that you see there today.
So if I was to describe it, and I'm going to go off what our local newspaper said, probably about 5 years ago, it was the worst zip code in all of Missouri. So high crime, activities that most folks wouldn't want to have, gang activity, drug houses. But I love growing up there because I had a very unique perspective because I grew up there, but I also went to Rockhurst High School, which is a pretty privileged high school. So I got to see both sides of the world, and really that's really shaped kind of the work that I do now.
Can you, when you say you really loved growing up there, what did you love about it? Like, what's the piece of that story that those newspaper reports from 5 years ago didn't tell?
The strong-knit neighbors that come together to look at challenges and try to affect change. I grew up right across the street from a park. So I got to see, you know, growing up with the young kids, the old kids, and how we, you know, kind of interacted together. And we would talk about the challenges and trying to make a difference and getting out. And
as so, kids?
As kids.
Aw.
As
Tell
kids.
Me more about that. Describe what you were discussing by the slides there.
You know, we were discussing some of the drug deals that would go down, some of the fighting that would go down, some of the various illicit activities that would go down. And so I would sit there with my mom and, you know, she would confront them and she would try to, because she's a teacher, and she would try to angle them toward other activities. And so now as we look at some of the work that's been done by Cheryl Barnes and those before her, the neighborhood president of Blue Hills, you now have investment coming in to do rehabs, to do new home building, things like that. So the neighborhood has really changed and has become a place where people want to come and grow and live in.
In some of the research we did before the show, I've noticed that you have quoted Bernard Powell, I believe, an old civil rights leader here in town. There's a statue of him over on Brooklyn. But his motto was, ghetto or goldmine, the choice is yours. What does that mean to you?
So that was really how I even got into this business. Bernard Powell, Social Action Committee of 20, had that belief. And so as opposed to looking at it as a ghetto, look at the opportunities there, the economic opportunities. Look beyond what you typically would see and what the perception is and look at those opportunities that can really help change and define a community. So that's what it means to me.
So in the time that you have been working to create change in neighborhoods where the neighborhoods themselves want change, where have you found yourself butting up against real limitations, like things that are just beyond your power to change?
Perception is one. Cost and value don't equal. And what I mean by that is, so wood, nails, steel is the same everywhere. But however, when I do a project, for example, when we did the shopping center, it cost us 20.
What shopping center are you talking about?
The shopping center on Blue Parkway, the shops on Blue Parkway. When we built that brand new, it cost $21 million to build. The appraisal came back, the initial appraisal came back at $13 million. And that's day one. So cost to build and value are not there.
Yeah, the value being tied really
to location.
To location.
To location. Location, location, location. And so where I may be able to go and borrow 50% on the dollar for land to help start a project or jumpstart a project, I don't get the benefit of that.
We were hearing our other guests talk about the area, the mile radius surrounding 18th and Vine. What are your thoughts about his comments about that area and how opportunity zones might affect it perhaps differently than previous efforts like empowerment zones and even just local efforts to rebuild 18th and Vine?
Well, the biggest difference is that the resources that Bruce spoke about are private, quicker. You can accelerate things. Typically, 18th and Vine has been had the benefit of having either city funds or some type of federal funding. It hasn't had the private market come in because with private dollars, it helps to accelerate things. And so that's the biggest difference. You know, we're talking about 18th and Vine, but right down the street, which is our base of operations, which as part of the five opportunity zones you spoke about, we are in the Swope area. And so over the last 20 years, Community Builders has developed what amounts to about $90 million of reinvestment. Most of that has been non-private.
You know, 18th and Vine is sometimes used as a case in point for people making the argument that reinvestment and development can't happen in little islands. Like, you can't try to do something on this block around 18th and Vine without really bolstering the whole neighborhood around it, for example. Do you see opportunity zones as an actual opportunity to do that part of it differently?
I see it as an opportunity that heretofore has not been there. So yes, I see that as a way to bring in private capital, to infuse it with public incentives, to begin to transform a community and make a catalytic, impactful development occur. Yes.
What were your initial thoughts when you heard about this program, these opportunity zones, which were wrapped into the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017?
Well, I'd heard a little bit about it in the Obama administration. That's where it was first surfaced, during the Obama administration. And so anytime there is a new opportunity to bring resources to a community that I live in and work in, then that's always a positive. So I was excited about it, but guarded.
Guarded because?
Because, you know, rather, and I think Bruce kind of alluded to, rather we call them opportunity zones, empowerment zones, enhanced enterprise communities, urban development action grants, UDAG communities, HODAG communities. They're all the same. They all impact low income, for the most part, communities or communities that have disinvestment in them. So whatever the new catchphrase is of the decade is, or the administration is, we've seen it. This is a little bit different because it brings private resources to the table to deploy.
From your perspective, how would this be different from TIFs, as long as we're talking about buzzwords?
So it's totally different. Tax increment financing uses the potential tax revenue over a 23-year period to do development. This is letting investors invest and keep all of the profits they make to themselves. So it's a little bit different. And also, remember, TIF is public. This is private.
What are your thoughts about the five places slated as opportunity zones here in Kansas City?
I agree with them all.
And how do you see, like, what is your greatest sign of hope and then your biggest fear going into this?
My greatest sign of hope would be that this will allow projects that have been dormant, particularly in neighborhoods, because our opportunity zones are a little bit different than what you see across the country.
Different how?
Ours focus on neighborhood. They're neighborhood driven, as opposed to in other cities and other locales. They're driven by either municipalities. Driven by either ballparks or something that is a large project that's probably been sitting on the shelf that's been waiting for something to happen. Ours are at the grassroots level, if you will, where we've targeted neighborhoods within this five various opportunity zones. That's the biggest difference.
And so then your greatest fear?
Is that with this investment or with this potential investment that we don't show enough impact to warrant the legislation being reenacted.
Okay, we've got to take a short break. You can join this conversation about opportunity zones in Kansas City. Do you think they have the potential to change the culture of investment in Kansas City? Could they spread the prosperity around to neighborhoods that need it a little more? Or do you see it playing out some other way? 816-235-2888 is the number to call with your perspective. 816-235-2888. I'm Gina Kaufman. We'll be right back. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman talking with Emmett Pearson, a longtime proponent of community reinvestment here in Kansas City. He's president of an organization called Community Builders. We've also got Bruce Katz on the line. He is paying close attention to opportunity zones across the country from the finance lab he directs at Drexel University. Hi, Bruce.
Hey, how are you?
Good. And hi, Emmett.
Hello.
So you can call 816-235-2888 to talk about what you are noticing in the opportunity zones you're familiar with here in town. Are you hopeful, skeptical? What's your take? 816-235-2888. I'm about to go to one of those callers, but Bruce, what do you hear in Emmett's take on this? Does Kansas City sound to you like a pretty typical case study nationwide, or do we have our own issues?
I think what Emmett really described was the fact that you have some community institutions with capacity and capital and community standing, like Community Builders, the organization he leads. And so in some respects, Kansas City may have a leg up here because groups like Community Builders have already shown that they can do the kind of transactions like the shopping center in Swope that he described that can have a positive impact on the lives of neighborhood residents. And the hope for opportunity zones is now to build on those investments and broaden it out, expand it out. So he's already set the table in some respects and now can help private investors amplify.
Do you see less, I guess, like, quote unquote, table setting in other communities in the country?
Oh, absolutely. In many parts of the United States, particularly in weak market cities, former industrial cities, you just don't see community institutions like Community Builders with this kind of capacity. So I think Kansas City basically is going to unveil for investors, and again, primarily local investors. You've got some organizations here that have been, you know, working in the vineyard, so to speak, for quite some time. Now's the time for private capital to follow the smart public and subsidized capital that has been put into these neighborhoods in the past 20 to 25 years. So that's the hope, and I think Kansas City has a leg up because of organizations like Community Builders, AltCap, and others.
Emmett, you're nodding.
I agree 100%. You know, Kansas City still has the community-based organizations that are still strong, not just Community Builders of Kansas City, Westside Housing, they're strong, and others. And I think Bruce referenced AltCap. You know, we came together when this legislation was being pushed forward and passed, and kind of got a coalition. So that coalition has been steadily trying to make strides, and we just hosted an investment summit about 6 weeks ago to kind of capitalize on just what Bruce was talking about.
Well, I want to turn to a caller. We've got Dan with us. This is actually Daniel Edwards calling us from the Kansas City's East Side. And Daniel, you have been a guest on the show. You are someone who is trying to build in a really grassroots way in the part of town you've grown up in. What are your thoughts about all of this conversation you're hearing?
Hey, Bruce. Hey, Emmett. How's it going, guys?
Good.
Hey, Gina.
Hi.
I think this conversation, over our experience, like Kansas City, the leadership in KC has done a really bad job about talking about opportunity zones from the investor perspective and not really from the how this impacts and how we can dream on the city block to block level. So I think that the opportunity zones and I think there's an opportunity for us to really start to dream about what can take place in these neighborhoods again. I just spent a week away in Montana concerning opportunity zones, and there is a ton of money out there, but there are not enough ideas. There are not enough projects. There are not enough what could be options, and not necessarily what could be options, but what also makes financial sense in these communities. Because at the end of the day, we're still dealing with private dollars, and private dollars are in a private system. And that system still doesn't like blighted neighborhoods and blighted communities. So we have to be creative about how we almost get ourselves or pull ourselves out of those red line areas that are still there. Some opportunity zones work better in KC from a marketing perspective. Some don't, because they're still in blighted red line areas and communities. So,
Daniel, would you give me an example of an area that you think like might really still have trouble making the case for outside investors for private dollars to come in and try to start their business in this place or try to expand their business into this place?
Yeah, I think 3rd and 5th District, east of 71 Highway, except for Truce Avenue. So everything outside of the Innovation District is going to struggle and need a little bit more oomph to it. There's an opportunity zone that is south of 435 in Martin City, and there's been projects after projects that have been announced out there in that area because it's an opportunity zone, but it still follows the same private capital system rules. But neighborhoods that have been demolished, abandoned, overlooked for so long, it just takes a lot more creativity to get to the end goal.
And so you're saying that it's that the case needs to be made to potential investors more than to the city, the city overall, for like, hey, wouldn't it be great to see this neighborhood improve? Most people would say, yeah. But then you're saying the case has not fully been made to investors for those neighborhoods.
Yeah, I think the neighborhood point that Emmett's made, that you just made, when we look at these deals over in these communities, we typically look at a single site deal. So, hey, can we put this affordable housing building here in the middle of this neighborhood? Or, hey, can we build a hotel here? Or, hey, can we build a luxury apartment here? I think what Opportunity Zones gives us the ability to do is to look at the neighborhood from a holistic perspective, the whole neighborhood at one time, and be able to educate investors of how we can really diversify their risk and decrease their risk over an entire neighborhood as opposed to a single site development. And it's just a different way and a different way to shift out of the traditional way of doing real estate and looking at how can we look at the whole as opposed to just the single piece of it.
Jump in here, Emmett.
If I could add to what Daniel has said, I like to look at it this way. What Daniel is describing in my mind is, as opposed to doing transactional development, Opportunity Zones allows for us to the opportunity to do transformational development, to where we can really begin to change what a community looks like and how it's viewed.
Can you speak a little bit to this idea about like needing to kind of sell investors with more than just the incentive?
I think it goes back to part of the reason I'm here today is because, as Bruce alluded to, you know, Community Builders has been around since 1991. We've done the large scale transaction. We've done the small scale transactions. And through all of that for 28 years, we have been able to show that these communities are viable, that they will come use the services and the goods and the housing. And oh, by the way, we are sophisticated enough to understand how to put them together and put the other resources together. And we have the staying power. If I'm an investor, I want to know, who else has done this to protect my money?
So make this case for me in like a particular location within one of these five opportunity zones. Just pick one and pretend I'm an investor. Make that case you were just sort of abstractly describing.
Sure. So I'm going to pick the Swope one.
Okay.
And so I would look at the case is that there's already a strong partner there that knows the political climate, that knows the neighborhoods, that's trusted by the neighborhoods, that's done the large scale investments from housing, institutional, that has come in and changed the whole complexion of a neighborhood, a neighbor that's gone from low income now to moderate income. That's the case. And oh, by the way, we haven't lost any money as we've been doing this. And we think we have laid out a comprehensive plan moving forward for the next 5 to 10 years.
Within the Blue Hills Opportunity Zone, within the Blue Valley Opportunity Zone, I guess, mm-hmm. What would you think? That seems like it would be more of kind of a like opportunities for more industrial projects?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And who has become the champion, one of the champions, is Greg Flissrum. Who has hit it right on the head. He has some great ideas there. You are correct. It is ripe for opportunity for manufacturing, industrial development.
Because there are large tracts of land that are essentially abandoned, not doing anything.
Large tracts of land, easy access to I-70, rail spur access. Yes, all of those things make for an attractive investment opportunity.
Bruce Katz, jump back in here.
Yeah, I think both Daniel and Emmett are making the point. The prior federal incentives tended to be very prescriptive. They basically said to investors or community institutions, you shall do low-income housing, or you shall do historic preservation. What this tax incentive basically is allowing investors, community institutions, private developers like Daniel to do is let's step back for a second and think about the different kinds of investments that need to be made to truly move a neighborhood forward and work for residents. That could be housing plus commercial real estate. That could be arts and culture investments. I mean, this is a radically different kind of tax incentive that allows a city and its neighborhoods to basically project its best case and then to work with investors to make these investments, along with other kinds of public incentives or philanthropic investments.
You know, I want to jump in.
The question is, who's going to really step up? Which city or cities are going to step up and take advantage of this?
I want to jump in while we've still got Daniel on the line to talk about the fact that the startup community seems fairly excited about this. The founder of 2030, the CEO of that organization, told Startland News that Kansas City's startup community is, quote, pushing uphill right now because investors aren't necessarily as comfortable taking risks here. And that includes investing in what you might consider like the road less traveled geographically. In other words, slow or no growth parts of town. And he sees this as a chance to change the culture of investment. Daniel, I want to get your thoughts on that, first of all, and then we'll hear from our in-studio guests after we say goodbye.
Yeah, so I agree 1,000,000% with that. Zennials, I guess we've been termed as the new subset of the millennial generation, the older half of that.
Wait, what is that word?
Zennials. With
Zennials. Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, I just been seeing this out there. You know, opportunity zones, it's really difficult to say like, hey, let's invest in a business. What's not difficult is, hey, let's invest in a real estate property. And what I want to encourage all entrepreneurs is to think about how can the property facilitate your business dreams? So if a real estate opportunity, like let's say a house or a co-working space on the east side could be invested in, that could facilitate the working space for an entrepreneur or maybe 20 entrepreneurs at one time. And if that opportunity zone can actually make that investment a more sound investment, as opposed to investing directly in a startup entrepreneur's business. So yes, we definitely want to get to a point where we can start throwing opportunity zone dollars, because the legislation was created around business. 95% of the legislation is about business. The other part is about real estate. But yet 99% of our talks go to the real estate part of it. So again, working in the system that is comfortable. One thing I learned this past week is like, you can't teach people what they don't want to learn, or you can't show people what they're not comfortable with and not what they're used to. People are used to real estate deals. So let's figure out how we can gather all the entrepreneurs up, put them in a space, a co-working space like Vector 90 is another big deal out of California that Nipsey Hussle was a part of. And mm-hmm. like give entrepreneurs the opportunity to co-create together in one space or dream, whether they're startup tech people or whether they're performing artists and they need a collective black box theater space to create in.
And that's kind of that's what you're working on.
Selfish plug, yeah.
Well, Daniel, thank you. And I'm going to get our guests to respond to all of this, but thanks so much for calling in.
Thank you. Have a good day, everybody.
You too.
Sure. You know, as a community real estate person, Daniel's right. I mean, I love doing the real estate deals, but the business investments. So I'm happy for the startups that they are happy. However, I'm going to say this selfishly. I don't see in the meetings that I'm in a lot of meetings, I don't see those startup businesses wanting to come east of 71 Highway or east of Troost.
I mean, that's a pretty bold statement.
I know. And I say that because as I look at what's going on, everybody wants to locate in the Crossroads. Everybody wants to locate at Rich Gebauer. Everybody wants to locate downtown. Very few people want to come and start a business in the shopping center at Linwood and Prospect or on Blue Parkway.
Why do you think?
Perception is one. There are others that we need to have a whole nother show to talk about
it.
That. Perception is a big one. They don't see the value of being on the east side. And again, I'm just looking at it from what I'm hearing. You know, when we talk about, when I look at the Business Journal and I see startup gets $200 million, what can a $200 million startup investment do in Daniel's neighborhood?
You know, I mean, I want to bring this up. There's that one of the big critiques of some of the development we've been seeing, like around where the station is, this radio station on 47th, 48th and Troost, a critique of the development we're seeing just right next door practically is that, you know, it's great that there is now a Planet Fitness, but where's the grocery store?
Well, the grocery store is about a mile and a half further east. But let's talk about that. Because even with the new grocery store at Linwood, and let's talk about our grocery store, we're still in a food desert. Still in a food desert. And so when we look around the development that's going around 48th and Troost where we are, you know, let's look at how that got jump started. Ollie Gates, private money, did it on his own. I'm going to do it my way. So he's done that. He's been the pioneer. He's been the trailblazer. But again, I'm going to go back to my statement. My question is with the Department of Ag, and I don't know what their parameters were on what the space they needed to have. I don't know that. But my question is, were they shown anything on the east side?
So there's still a lot more to talk about that has maybe not even so much to do with opportunity zones. It's just our city is going to still have the issues that we have, the perceptions that we have. We're still going to have to work through those.
Absolutely.
Well, Emmett Pearson, thanks so much for being here. And Bruce Katz, thank you.
No, thanks for having me.
Up next, how New Deal artists left a lasting impact on rural Kansas. It has to do with post office art, and it's a pretty cool story. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard. Stay with us. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and a documentary that's been showing around town lately tells a local history story that I'd never heard until now, the story of how the New Deal put really amazing art in 29 Kansas post offices, art that for the most part is still there in small Kansas communities today. The historian and filmmaker duo that's been telling the story, they're with me now, historian Kara Heitz. Good morning.
Good morning, Gina.
And filmmaker Graham Carroll. Hi.
Hi.
So between 1934 and 1943, the U.S. Treasury Department commissioned more than 1,600 pieces of public art for newly constructed post office buildings across the United States. Kansas is home to 29 of these murals and other kinds of artwork. And yet, you say in your writing about this that the thousands of Kansans who have walked past these murals in their day-to-day lives have, for the most part, only sort of half registered their existence. Graham, I want you to start us off on this because you grew up around these post offices.
Yeah, that's right. I think, there was a post office in my sort of my ancestral home of Okemah, Oklahoma, which is where Woody Guthrie is also from. But these post offices, they have these large murals. They're sort of out of the way. They're up above eyesight. So I think generally folks aren't always looking up. You know, we look around and down. But it also, I think, because they're so large and sort of old-timey looking, they might sort of fade into the background for the average person who's just going about their business at the post office.
And also, I think there's something about these places that feel like they've been there forever, and maybe you started going to them when you were like two, that you just don't fully stop and say, I get a very distinct kind of feeling in this space. It's not like other spaces in my life. there's stuff going on here, but you just don't stop and really consider the places that have been around forever.
Yeah, it's sort of like they just grew out of the ground. You know, it's hard to imagine someone actually building these places or painting these murals.
Kara, tell us more about the history of why these artworks exist and how they were commissioned.
Sure. Well, you have to remember that when this program started, we're in the middle of the Great Depression, right? And obviously, there's a lot of federal government programs being implemented to help the nation recover, to give relief to people. And so when we think about these New Deal programs, we think about bridges and roads and schools and swimming pools and all of these public works projects. But, you know, the federal government also recognized, you know, the Roosevelt's administration and administrators working for him, that people needed to feel uplifted and positive. And they needed, you know, images to give them hope in their daily lives. So that was the impetus for this particular program that we're looking at, which is called the Section of Fine Arts, originally a Treasury Department
program.
And
they just called it the Section, which I love.
Well, like many New Deal programs, there was sort of this, the name changed. It was originally the Section on Painting and Sculpture, and then the Section of Fine Arts, and originally it was Treasury Department, and then it moved to a different, it's just easier, right? It's like the Section, that's much easier.
The artists included on the roster are pretty, it's an impressive group of artists, but if I remember from the documentary, they were selected anonymously, so it wasn't like the name recognition was really carrying them, unless their style was super recognizable.
Right. So the anonymity was actually part of the Section's emphasis on what they thought was democratic art. Part of the one aspect of democratic art is giving the public a topic or a theme that they can connect to, and so artists were encouraged to do that. But I think a more controversial aspect is the anonymity of the artists, that they didn't want communities just picking their favorite person. They wanted to give opportunities to a lot of artists who maybe otherwise wouldn't have gotten those opportunities. Women, for example. There's Native American artists in Oklahoma who were given opportunities, for example. So, but that actually caused some controversy.
Yeah. Tell the story about what happened. Was it in Salina?
Oh, yeah. Well, there's a lot of stories about where it causes controversy. But Graham, do you want to?
Well, in Salina, the artists that were selected were two artists from sort of a husband and wife duo, Isabel Bates and Harold Black, from New York City. And when they were chosen, they started to prepare these sketches for the murals that would go in the Salina post office. It was one of the biggest post offices in the state, I believe. So they had room for eight murals. And folks in Salina kind of at first they caught wind of some Yankees coming down to paint murals, and they weren't super happy about it.
Yeah, there was a picture in the documentary of, you know, people in overalls standing in the fields looking nonplussed.
that's Graham's artistic touch right there. So, and I will say the Salina story, which we sort of end the documentary with, it's one of the last commissions to sort of finish up in this program. We tell about, I would say, 20% of the story in the documentary. It could have its own documentary. It has lots of
ins and outs. It sounds like it should.
Yeah. But really at the heart is, you know, what does it mean to make democratic art?
Well, so these murals never went up. And in fact, they're missing. Nobody can find them. Eight giant murals, right?
Right. So Bate and Black, the married couple, they were commissioned to do them in 1940, and they take 2 years to complete a series of eight murals. And in the meantime, something pretty monumental happens in American history, Pearl Harbor, right? We enter World War II. And so these programs start to wind down, and criticism of what we should be spending money on also starts to come in. So it isn't just about the artists anymore. It's about what should we be doing during wartime. But Bate and Black do finish the murals. They ship them to Salina. They crate them in New York City, ship them in Salina. The postmaster prevents them from uncrating them. They actually put them in the basement of the Salina post office.
Did they look at them first, or was it just like, nope, these New York City artists are not going in our post office?
There was already 2 years of controversy. There was a local artist who had seen them when they exhibited in New York a few months earlier, and he writes back, these are atrocious and they're horrible and they don't represent Salina. So people already were quite angry about them and have been.
This is such a topic today, though, this question of representation. Like, if this is going to be our post office, shouldn't it reflect us, not someone in New York? And that's such a question in news coverage today, in media today, in movies and books and art. And it's amazing to me that, you know, these conversations are not new.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think there's a lot of parallels to be drawn between today's world and the world of the 1930s and 40s. You know, there was a rise of demagogues and sort of totalitarianism. But there was also this really exciting sort of shining moment for democracy and for its advocates. But also for, these pieces they could be considered pro, you know, United States federal government propaganda. So even though it is sort of this wonderful democratic process and this democratic program to produce art for people, everyday folks who aren't living in the big fancy cities, it's also, you know, there's sort of this question about...
There's an agenda.
That's right. There is a political agenda.
Tell me about the art in the Russell, Kansas post office. I really loved this story. There are so many, like, good little fun facts tucked into it, too.
Yeah, so Wheat Workers is the name of the mural in Russell, Kansas, and it's done by an artist. Her name was Suzanne Schweig. Later, her married name was Suzanne Langsdorf, but she went by the name Martill. And she was, I believe, 22 years old when she received the commission. So a lot of established artists are receiving these section commissions, but a lot of young artists. And
just as a note, you look at old timey photographs and everyone looks much older. She looks like she's about 12.
Yeah, she does.
So she does look incredibly young. But, you know, what's fascinating about her is she had a long, productive and very interesting artistic career.
And so, very anonymous. I would say, so she designed the Doomsday Clock. That's amazing, but that doesn't come with a name on it, like a signature. When I saw that, I was just like, what? The artist who did a mural in the post office in Russell, Kansas, designed the Doomsday Clock, which is this design thing, very simple, that exists in the entire popular imagination, using just a few dots and like weird shaped liney things. And it's amazing.
Yeah.
That's an amazing accomplishment in a career.
I mean, her career is very much marked by kind of the intersection of art and science. At one point later in her career, she does a series of works that are inspired by neural networks in the brain. I mean, she has a very interesting portfolio. So I don't know if I...
When I say anonymously, it's because I was inspired by your documentary to go look up more about her. And there isn't really that much. There's not a book about her. You know, there were some obituaries. That's about it.
Well, I don't.
I think a lot of these projects or a lot of the artists aren't so well known. No. Some of them are, you know, famous. Berger St. Zane, actually, it's worth mentioning that our project was made possible by a grant from Humanities Kansas. And we also partnered with the Berger St. Zane Memorial Gallery in beautiful Lindsberg, Kansas. But Berger St. Zane is sort of a famous artist. He's got a piece at the Nelson Atkins sort of on permanent display. And but other artists who were making art of, you know, debatably of the same quality are you know, much less known, or maybe they sort of disappeared after doing their work during the Great Depression.
I mean, that's true of any sort of creative profession, right? I mean, who are the names that we remember, that we know, even after they're gone? I mean, there's a lot of talented, incredibly talented people that just simply never make it as so big that. You know, the average person sort of knows about them, but...
You know, Kara, part of what you covered in the documentary also had to do with having, like, the post office and mail delivery be a public good. And there has been talk recently about reprivatizing, but the sort of revolution for rural America, a lot of the Kansas communities we're talking about, and having mail delivery not determined by distance, but by weight of the parcel.
Right. I mean, rule-free delivery was an important development for a lot of Americans who didn't live in urban areas, who lived on farms, who lived in, you know, a considerable distance, right, from a post office. And a lot of the murals celebrate that. I mean, that's in a way why we talk about them, some of them as propaganda, right, because they're talking about showing us how great the federal government is. Look what we do for you. We're celebrating this in our art.
And this is one of the few places that a bunch of people from a wide geographic area are all going to touch down. Well,
absolutely.
Our time is up. Graham Carroll, Kara Heights, thank you both so much.
Thank
Their
you.
Movie is A New Deal for Public Art in the Free Space. Thank you so much.
Thank you,
thank
Gina.
You.
You can keep up with local events and screenings on their website, but we will link to that with the audio from today's show. That might be easier. It'll be at kcur.org/centralstandard by the end of the day. And again, we will link to where you can find out more about the documentary. That's a wrap. Talk to us on Twitter about whatever's on your mind, especially keep talking about public art, which we've been discussing now, and opportunity zones, which we discussed earlier. We are at KCUR. CST. This show is produced by Melody Rowell with Ann Kniggendorf and intern Riley Kester. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next.